dollar plus weekend, which is fucking great. Like the kind of thing that might never happen for an actor or writer or director ever in their career. And I wasn't taking that for granted at all. It's hard to make a movie that really resonates with audiences, and it seemed we had made one. The next day, we were going to have the Los Angeles premiere. We'd settled on decent middle ground on the head blowing up, but Linton was getting cold feet. The morning of the premiere, I was called into his office. The flames licked around his giant throne made of bones.
Look, we're going to put together a version of the death where the whole thing is obscured by fire so you don't actually see anything. And also, because of the hack, the press now knows there's been some back and forth about this. So if you're asked about this, I need you to say that you wanted to do it.
But I don't.
Yeah, but it's best for the movie if you just say you do.
Changing the movie in a way you think is bad and then lying about it publicly isn't usually a good thing, never mind the best thing. It's usually a fucking terrible and dumb thing. I hate lying to the press in interviews. I pretty much reverse engineer a lot of my career decisions knowing that one day I'll be promoting my work, and I don't want to feel like I'm lying to anyone. I don't want to trick people into seeing my shit. I want to make shit they want to see, and then talking about it is easy. I know one day I'll be sitting across from Howard Stern, and he'll grill the shit out of me for everything I've done since seeing him last, and I truly want to be able to speak openly and honestly about my life and career choices. So this seemed like it was going to fuck all that up. But the chairman of the studio releasing your movie is a hard dude to say no to. So I said yes. We'd screen the movie as it currently was at the premiere that night, but tomorrow we'd change it to ready it for release. That night we had the L.A. premiere at the United Artists Theater downtown. It was pouring rain, which always makes L.A. feel like the movie Seven. In other words, a wonderful vibe. We took pictures on the red carpet, but didn't actually talk to journalists, and I vaguely remember running away from someone from Variety when they tried to interview me. Halfway through the movie, I took two large capsules filled with MDMA crystals. By the time the movie ended, they were kicking in hard. We went to the top floor of the hotel for a party, and the mood was oddly good. The movie had played really well, and even though there was a tornado of shit swirling around us, for a moment it seemed like we were in the calm eye of the storm. Then the head of visual effects for Sony came up to me and Evan.
I got the new version of the shot.
Huh? What?
You know, the conversation you and Michael had this morning about the new version of the shot. I have it.
Where?
On my phone. We gotta approve tonight.
And we gotta approve it on your phone?
Yep. We have to deliver the movie to theaters tomorrow. We have to approve this now.
We went into the bathroom of one of the hotel rooms, and I was rolling my goddamn ass off. My face was sweating. My body was tingling. With every breath, a wave of euphoria swept away the anxiety that was fighting to take over. The VFX guy held up his phone, and we watched the shot, which essentially was just CG flames rolling over the frame for like 15 seconds. You really couldn't see anything at all, and it was on a phone, circa 2014.
Can we shorten the shot?
What do you mean?
Well, the length of the shot is what it is because we're holding to show his head explode. But without that, there's no reason to hold the shot for so long. It's just kind of weird.
No, we can't open editorial again. Just VFX.
Me and Evan looked at each other. It just sucked so bad. It's an odd feeling when you're on tons of MDMA and something really shitty is happening. Your body doesn't quite know how to compute it. I started seeing spots as my torso went numb. I'm going to talk to Michael tomorrow. I don't think we can do this. I emailed Linton that night saying we needed to talk in the morning. First thing in the morning. When I woke up, I realized I maybe should have made the meeting second or even third thing in the morning because I was still incredibly high. I'd say about 64% high. But the meeting was set. I showered and took a cab to Sony because I honestly didn't think I could drive. I was nervous when I got there, so I stopped at the coffee bean to get a big cup of coffee, thinking that might keep my sober edge sharp. I chugged the coffee and hurried to Linton's office, but the mixture of caffeine and my heart pumping from being nervous made the remnants of the MDMA start to race through my veins. As I walked up to the desk outside his office, I found myself 100% high again.
Hi, it's up for Michael.
You can head in. He'll be with you in a second.
I went into his huge office and sat across from the empty desk. I felt like I was in the movie Network, about to be yelled at for meddling with the forces of nature. I thought to myself, all right, maybe he'll leave me waiting in here for a bit and I could chill out, take a few deep breaths, maybe drink some water. And by then I'll be a bit less high. And then he walked in.
Yes.
Look, I can't do it. I can't lie. Either we leave the shot how it is, which I already don't love, or we can change it, but I'm not going to pretend that it was my idea. And if anyone asks me, I'm going to be honest and say, you made us change it. He stared at me for a while with a look that made me think, has this motherfucker had people killed? He kind of looks like he has. And if he has, is this a killable offense? Then he said,
I understand.
That's it?
Yep, that's it.
All right. Everything went way worse from there on out. I went to New York to start doing the final week of promotion, and the reviews started to come out, and they were pretty shitty. There's nothing more fun than reading a terrible review of your movie in USA Today on your phone as you walk into an interview with a journalist from USA Today. Here's my stamp of approval on your trash talking of my film. I condone this outlet and their message. Meanwhile, the media kept delving more and more into the hacked emails and finding more and more stuff that they deemed publishable. Hilariously, the original shot of the head blowing up was released online by Gawker, which I could appreciate the irony of in a Morissettian way. But it's also never great when the grand finale shot of your film is released online by a website a week before the movie is supposed to come out. On December 17th, we were supposed to have a New York premiere, and I was in a car on my way to do Fallon. As we got close to 30 Rock, the news reported that there were threats of violence against theaters that showed the movie. All of a sudden, the idea of doing a lip-sync battle to promote the film seemed wrong. The premiere was canceled that night, and I was flooded with calls for comment. I didn't know what to say, which is an admission I should probably arrive at more often, so I said nothing. The press was split in a lot of ways at this point, but there was a ton of don't poke the bear messaging being thrown our way, which is crazy. I agree. Don't poke a bear. But dictators aren't bears. Bears are animals that don't know any better than to follow their natural instincts. Dictators are pieces of shit who deserve ridicule. A lot of people I knew from Hollywood were giving me advice on what to say. Pull the movie. Tell Kim Jong-un to go fuck himself and get behind free speech. Ask the government to get involved. The best advice came from Sacha Baron Cohen, who, of all the people in the world, was probably in the best position to understand how to navigate this. After Borat, he too had alienated an entire country. Kazakhstan, and although they didn't have nearly good enough technology to hack a studio, the situation was comparable.
Say nothing, just keep your fucking mouth shut. If you want more attention, talk. If you want less, say nothing at all. If you talk, you give them more to write about, more quotes. If you just shut up, there's nothing to report.
I said nothing, and of all the shit I did throughout that time, it was one of the smarter things, but it's clearly advice I've since stopped listening to. Sony didn't really communicate anything with me directly at that point, so I just went back to L.A. While I was on the plane, they announced that they were pulling the movie from its planned theatrical release. I landed and was pissed. I called Linton. You specifically promised me you wouldn't pull the movie. You knew all this was going to happen.
Nobody could have known this was going to happen.
Actually, the Rand Corporation, who you hired, knew this was going to happen, and they told us as much about it 5 months ago. I was there. That's why I hired cybersecurity, and I wasn't hacked.
Look, right now, you feel like we're making a mistake. But you're alone in that feeling. Everyone I've talked to feels we're making the right decision. Industry-wide, it's being viewed as the wisest choice.
I really think it's wrong, and I'm going to come out and say it unless we work on a way to let the theaters that want to show the film be allowed to show it and we find a streaming platform to release it before the end of the year.
Again, I understand that right now you feel like we're making a mistake and new actions need to be taken, but let's just wait a day. Tomorrow, President Obama is giving his year-end press conference. Let's see if this comes up, see what he says, and move forward from there.
This was incredibly ominous for one big reason. Linton knew President Obama. He was a huge supporter of his, and from the way he was talking, it felt like he had some sort of inside track on what the president was going to say. And it really seemed like he thought whatever President Obama was going to say would support him in his decisions, which was terrifying to me. The next morning, we all gathered in our office, which was actually on the Sony lot, and turned on the TV just as the press conference was about to start. Part of me didn't really think the president would even mention us. It was the year-end press conference. Surely there'd be more important things to talk about. Nope, it was the first question, and the second question, and a bunch of ones after that.
Thank you, Mr. President. Start in North Korea, because that seems to be the biggest topic today. Did Sony make the right decision in pulling the movie, or does that set a dangerous precedent when faced with this kind of situation?
Sony's a corporation. It suffered significant damage. There were threats against its employees. I am sympathetic to the concerns that they faced.
We were devastated. It seemed as though Linton had pulled some magic trick and gotten the President of the United States himself to support his argument. But then he continued.
Having said all that, yes, I think they made a mistake.
We literally exploded in applause. He went on.
We cannot have a society in which some dictator someplace can start imposing censorship here in the United States. Because if somebody is able to intimidate folks out of releasing a satirical movie, imagine what they start doing when they see a documentary that they don't like, or news reports that they don't like. Or even worse, imagine if producers and distributors and others start engaging in self-censorship because they don't want to offend the sensibilities of somebody whose sensibilities probably need to be offended. So, you know, that's not who we are. That's not what America's about. Again, I'm sympathetic that Sony, as a private company, was worried about liabilities and this and that and the other. I wish they had spoken to me first. I would have told them, do not get into a pattern in which you're intimidated by these kinds of criminal attacks. I think it says something interesting about North Korea that they decided to have the state mount an all-out assault on a movie studio because of a satirical movie. I love Seth, and I love James. But the notion that that was a threat to them, I think, gives you some sense of the kind of regime we're talking about here.
He put Sony on blast. Linton called a few hours later to figure out how to get the movie to theaters that wanted it and to find a streaming platform to partner with. It premiered on Google Play at the end of December, and that's when even more reviews started to come out. In what is definitely the most revealing thing about me, the piece of all this that I still carry around, is that the film was negatively received for the most part. The question of, was it all worth it for this movie, became a popular one. If critics had liked it more, would it have been more worthwhile? Because it didn't align with their taste? It wasn't. That conversation was frustrating and, frankly, really painful. But getting shitty reviews always hurts. I'm not sure if critics don't realize how much their words can hurt someone, or they just don't care. Maybe they see brutal criticism as a painful but necessary part of our lives, like going to the dentist. All this is to say that it actually hurts. But what hurt much more than critics talking shit about it was other comedians talking shit. I try not to publicly malign the work of other comedians unless I genuinely dislike them on a personal level. Probably because I'm so sensitive to it that the idea of subjecting someone else to it seems crazy. But around the release of the movie and in the months following, people I really respected started mocking the movie. Not just what happened with it. They literally were saying it was shitty. A joke Amy Poehler and Tina Fey made at the Golden Globes that year was particularly painful, not only because I look up to them so much, but because I knew they were right and that the movie itself wasn't as good as it could have been. For the weeks surrounding the release, the studio demanded we all have armed security with us 24 hours a day. I didn't like it. It made me uncomfortable. And the whole time we were like, do we really need these guys? This is silly. Aren't we just drawing more attention to the whole situation, like North Korea is going to send an assassin to West Hollywood? Then one day, in early January, I came outside to walk to the coffee shop expecting to see my guard, but he was gone. Vanished. Nowhere to be found. At first I was like, was he taken out? Is this an attack? I called Evan. Is your guard still there?
No, I just went outside. He's gone.
I guess we're not in danger anymore?
I guess not.
Did the studio call to say they were relieving the guy of duty or whatever?
No, he's just gone.
I'm starting to miss that guy.
Me too. I felt so safe with him around.
In the following weeks, I worried that the movie would be on me like a stain forever, that people would never look at me the same way again, and that maybe people just wouldn't think I was funny anymore. What I really learned, though, was how fucking fast people forget shit and move on. Once again, an inflated sense of self-importance ultimately made the fallout not as bad as I thought it would be. By mid-January, I was in San Francisco rehearsing for the Steve Jobs movie. Kate Winslet turned to me and was like,
"What was with that whole North Korea mess, dear? Did anything ever come of that?"
"I guess not." Amy stepped down that February and set up a production company. She always joked that if she wasn't the head of the studio, she'd be in our offices, the schoolhouse as it was known on the lot. Turns out it wasn't a joke. She kicked us out of our offices to set up her own. There was a news story about how she had to let them air out for a week to get rid of the weed smell, which seems like an exaggeration of at least a day or two. We were moved into one of Adam Sandler's storage rooms. For real. We never got full ownership of one of the closets in the office, and every few days, someone from Happy Madison Productions would come into our reception area to grab toilet paper. Since stepping down, Amy's won 2 Oscars and been nominated for another 2. Michael Linton, who always claimed there was no way he could have seen any of this coming, even though I saw him warned about it months earlier, left the company soon after and is now on the board of Snapchat. So next time some high school senior sends his girlfriend dick pics, Linton will be cashing a check. He also remains the lord of the underworld and its flaming dominions of torment, LUFDT for short. Cut to 2018. A charismatic yet completely moronic TV show host, who is also president, but I'm sure critics would have said that was way too broad for our film, gets an invite to go to North Korea. He accepts with the intention of showing Kim Jong-un who's boss. Trump had always been hard on Kim. He would make fun of him, calling him Rocket Man and stupid shit like that. But once he got there, he actually liked him. When he got back from his trip, he had this to say about his meeting.
"When I did it, and I was really being tough, and so was he, and we would go back and forth, and then we fell in love, okay? No, really. He wrote me beautiful letters, and they're great letters. We fell in love."
He fell in love with the motherfucker. In the movie, the stupid talk show host eventually finds out that Kim was tricking him and exposes him as a fraud. Trump hasn't quite gotten there yet. In early 2020, after there were rumors that Kim Jong-un had died following a botched surgery, he resurfaced, and Trump couldn't have been more psyched. I'm glad to see he's back and well. I shudder when I think about what would have happened if Trump was president when all this shit went down. He'd have sent my fucking head to North Korea in a box in exchange for some beautiful letters. As strange a time as it was, there was a lot of bright spots. Lauren couldn't have been more supportive and wonderful. In the midst of the mayhem, I got an email from Russell Crowe, who I'd only met a couple times, inviting me to his ranch in Australia to hide if I needed to. I said no, but it always struck me as nice. George Clooney tried to get all the heads of the major studios to sign a letter in solidarity with Sony and the film. None of them would sign it, but I appreciate the attempt. The fact that George Clooney spent even one afternoon thinking of me is flattering. Every once in a while, I'll be flipping channels and see the movie playing on FX or Comedy Central. At one point, this was the most controversial film in the world. People thought they could die if they screened it. And now, it's playing on basic cable at 3 p.m. and is brought to you by Charmin, which is a superior toilet paper in both thickness and softness. So I take that as a win. Tigers! In our extensive research about North Korea, one of the most interesting tidbits that stuck out to us was that there are wild tigers there, and it seemed like it could potentially be interesting to include that in the interview in some way. We had a scene where the CIA is trying to drop a little remote control missile with a poison strip in it in a field outside Kim Jong-un's fortress, and my character has to sneak into the field to retrieve it. We thought it would be funny if I encountered a tiger, which attacks me and is ultimately killed by the missile that I was sent to retrieve. At first, the obvious idea was to use a CGI tiger. The movie Life of Pi had recently come out, and the fake tiger in that movie was pretty fucking great. But we very quickly deduced that we didn't have nearly the budget to make a convincing fake tiger, so the idea came up to use a real tiger. If you've ever made a movie or TV show or know anyone who has, the phrase children and animals comes up a lot as the two things you want to avoid filming if you can. And there's good reason. They're dangerous and difficult and time consuming. I once did a photo shoot where I had a small monkey on my shoulder and was fucking blown away when I met the monkey because it was Marcel, the monkey from Friends. This was a famous ass monkey. Honestly, this monkey had a better resume than I do from both a quality and box office standpoint. This was as professional a monkey as you could ask for. I was psyched. Oh man, can I hug him?
No, don't make any sudden movements. Don't raise your voice. Try not to laugh too loud. If he's startled, he may try to bite your nose off.
Fucking Christ. The headline that I had my nose bit off by the monkey from Friends was not really something I wanted to see, mostly because it for sure would have made me laugh if it happened to another celebrity. And a tiger, on the grand scale of animals you don't want to work with, is pretty fucking high. And, as with children, the animals themselves often aren't the worst part. It's their parents slash owners. But we liked the joke, so we plowed forward. We were filming in Vancouver and were told that the tiger itself had to come from Canada because I guess getting a tiger over the border is hard, which is probably a good thing. There was really only one option, hiring a tiger wrangler from Calgary named Randy. We were sent some photos of his tigers and they were, in fact, big ass fucking tigers. He sent us a link to a video of him using a big fishing rod type thing with a lure, having the tigers run around, jump on boxes, wrestle with him, you know, crazy tiger dude type shit. The guy himself looked and dressed kind of like Indiana Jones if Indiana Jones had gained 60 pounds and was not as attractive as Harrison Ford in the first place. If you've seen Tiger King, you get the general vibe of one who works with tigers, and that vibe, my friend, is a weird one. We are like, perfect. Let's send him the script so he can read the scene in context, and we'll see what he says. In the scene, I climb out of a window under the cover of night and crawl into a big open field to retrieve the missile, and that's where I encounter the tiger. We're about a dozen feet apart, staring at each other. Then the tiger charges, and I try to run, but it tackles me just as the missile hits it in the head, killing it. Few days later, we got a message that Randy had read the script and thought it was no problem whatsoever, which made sense. In the grand scale of tiger shit, this seems simple. He was supposed to stand there looking at me, roar, and then run at me and tackle me. This part would be Randy in my wardrobe. Then it would be replaced by a fake dead tiger. We were scheduled to shoot the scene in about 6 weeks, and Randy said he would lose weight to make sure he could fit into my wardrobe and effectively double me in the scene.
I've been looking for an excuse anyway. It's perfect.
We began shooting, and about a week before the tiger scene, we had a call with Randy to go over the last-minute details before he drove the tiger from Calgary to Vancouver. If there was a checklist of things you did not want to hear a tiger trainer say, he hit every single item. Hey, Randy, how's the weight loss going? I hope good. I'm not trying to be in a lot of scenes with this tiger.
Oh, yeah, it's great. Perfect. I feel great. All right, I just want to go over some details.
All right, cool.
So this scene, it's not literally being filmed in a big open field, is it?
Yeah, of course it is.
Okay.
Is that bad?
It's just a bit harder to contain them in big open areas.
Okay, is that a problem?
No, it should be okay.
Okay, as long as you're sure.
I am, as long as there's no chance that, like, a deer or something might be in the area.
Well, we're filming in Squamish, which is in the mountains outside Vancouver, and there's actually a very good chance there'll be deer in the area.
Okay.
Is that bad?
Well, if the tiger sees one, he might run after it. That'll be hard to contain. But, you know, as long as there's lights and crew around, I'm sure the deer will stay away. It'll be fine.
You sure?
Yep, completely.
Okay.
As long as we're not shooting at night.
Well, the scene is set in the middle of the night, and we are filming it at night.
Oh.
Is that a problem?
Well, tigers hunt at night.
Okay.
So, you know, they're a lot more aggressive at night.
Well, is that going to be an issue?
You know, it might be good. He'll be more lively, give a better performance.
Are you sure?
Yep, completely. It's fine. This is a good tiger. He'll be great, as long as it's not raining.
Well, it's the Pacific Northwest. In February, it'll almost definitely be raining. Silence. Is that bad?
Well, the rain really agitates them.
Should we not do this?
About 15 seconds of silence.
No, it's fine. We'll be fine.
You sure?
Yep.
The night the tiger arrived, I was incredibly nervous. I turned to Evan, who was co-directing the film with me, and I was like, there's no actual reason for me and this tiger to be anywhere near each other. We can just shoot it in halves and combine the shots. You'll never know I wasn't near it.
If we have time. We didn't really schedule it that way. It'll take twice as much time to shoot it like that.
I just don't want to be in the same physical vicinity as the tiger.
As long as Randy lost weight and doubles you well, you shouldn't really have to be.
We walked up to the set and saw an animal trailer parked to the side of the giant valley we were shooting in. Then I saw Randy in my wardrobe, but not a pound smaller than he was before. He looked nothing like me at all. He might have even gained weight.
You lost weight?
No, I didn't. I've been wearing the same suit for the last 5 weeks.
Well, I guess I was going off how you used to look, because you lost weight, it seems.
As a side note, people are always treating me like I just lost a ton of weight, even though I've basically been the same weight since 2009, which is kind of nice and also kind of insulting.
Well, I don't think you're going to be able to double me.
Then let's have you meet Frank.
Who's Frank? A thinner tiger trainer?
No, he's the tiger. If you're going to shoot with him, he should start getting used to you.
I don't want to shoot with him or get to know him at all.
Then what should we do?
I looked over at Evan, who looked at me like, fuck you, go meet the tiger. This is one of the instances where directing and acting really come in conflict with one another. Fine. I walked over to the trailer with Randy and his 16-year-old son, who is also a tiger trainer, as Evan and the rest of the crew stood a few hundred yards away, watching. The trailer door opened, and out walked a tiger. He came right up to me. His head was the diameter of a manhole cover and went up to my chest. It was truly terrifying, and it made me think that anyone who thought that keeping these things in cages was a good idea was a complete weirdo, which made me further question the judgment of Randy, who held my life in his hands at this point, which then made me really question my own judgment, because I was actually trusting my life with this weirdo and his tiger. Frank nuzzled against me a few times, walking around me in circles. It was astonishing.
He likes you.
How can you tell? He's not eating me?
Exactly.
Where did you get this tiger?
I bought it from a stripper. She had a tiger cub as part of her act, and then she realized it was going to eat her on stage eventually.
Yeah, hilarious. As we began filming the scene, I realized I would actually have to lie on the ground on my stomach in front of the tiger, which is way scarier than standing in front of it. I couldn't have been more vulnerable. The tiger was doing what it was supposed to do for the most part. At one point, we wanted a shot of it roaring, but it wouldn't do anything other than just sit there with a normal tiger face.
I know what to do. Don't tell anyone about this.
He proceeded to go behind the tiger trailer, piss in his glove, and approached the tiger.
You rolling?
We were. He rubbed his pissy glove at the tiger's face, which didn't make it roar, but instead opened its mouth and recoil as if it was saying, really, motherfucker? After all this, you're rubbing piss in my fucking face? Randy turned back to us proud.
You can put a roar sound in there in post. It'll look like he's roaring.
What's annoying is he was right. I've never been more relieved than I was when I saw Frank get loaded back in his truck, but I honestly felt terrible for the animal. I eventually found an online campaign with the mission of shutting down Randy and his tiger zoo, and I donated a bunch of money to it. Today, Randy and his tiger farm are no longer in operation. I still think of that tiger and hope he's doing okay, and that before they closed the zoo, he took a big bite out of Randy's fat ass. Verification. What would you do if the president told his followers to kill a specific American citizen? I asked Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter. Long silence.
I'd like to think that would be something that would require some action.
You'd like to think? You haven't talked about it?
Not that specifically.
So you'd like to think it would require some action, but you're not sure that it would? Maybe you'd just let him tell his followers to kill someone?
Well...
The call was not going well. I vividly remember my dad telling me at a young age,
people hate Jews.
I didn't really believe him. It just didn't make sense. Jews? Us? What's to hate? But as I got older, I realized that for sure, yes, people hate Jews. My friends in high school would say wedge as a word for cheap, which I didn't realize until years later was Jew spelled backwards. We said so many stupid things and my antenna was so not tuned to anti-Semitism that it didn't even register. It wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that I was like, oh, those guys were all being horrible to us. I think one of the reasons people hate Jews is because we pass for non-Jews. We're interlopers. Shh, we could be anywhere. And we might look like white Christians, but we don't believe what they believe, which just freaks the fuck out of people. There's almost an implicit deception at play. People feel tricked by Jews, and people only like being tricked by magicians and wizards who, not coincidentally, are very likely visually based on Jews. Once I started working in Hollywood, anti-Semitism was more hidden for the most part. There are a lot of Jewish people working in the entertainment industry, an industry that was essentially created by Jewish people, so it adds up. Just like there are a lot of Swedish people in the assemble-it-yourself furniture industry. The first really overt act of aggressive anti-Semitism happened in the last place I would have expected it. An elevator with Eddie Griffin at the opening of the Planet Hollywood Las Vegas Resort and Casino. It was 2007, and to help celebrate the opening of the new Planet Hollywood, they offered to fly a bunch of famous people to Vegas to essentially go to parties for a few days. Me and Lauren thought it sounded fun, and a few of our other friends said they would go too. The first night we went to a party where I met Sylvester Stallone. Sylvester Stallone is a name that has been in my life for as long as I can remember. He's been famous since I've had any real cognition, and his name never sounded that strange to me. But then I met him.
Hi, I'm Sylvester.
His voice rumbled my loins like a lion's roar. Hi, Sylvester. That's when I realized that there is no other human on Earth named Sylvester. There's a cartoon cat named Sylvester, but literally no other human I've ever met. I've been alive for almost 40 years. I've met a grand total of one Sylvester, and it was Stallone. It's a very rare name. And to say the name of Sylvester out loud to a person named Sylvester really makes you realize just how strange a name Sylvester is. It's bizarre, but for some reason, Sylvester Stallone isn't that weird. The Stallone somehow anchors it in normalcy, but you take that away and you find yourself with just Sylvester dangling out there like a dick in the breeze, and you understand how odd it is. If you're thinking, that's not that weird a name, then you're just exposing yourself as someone who's never been face-to-face with a Sylvester. And by that I mean, you're somebody who has never met Sylvester Stallone, because again, there is only one Sylvester on the planet, and it's him. This isn't a singular phenomenon. I always thought Sigourney Weaver was a pretty normal name until I met her. The Weaver is doing a lot of heavy lifting with that one. It makes the whole name roll off the tongue. But when a tall, beautiful woman comes up to you backstage at Comic-Con and says,
Hi, I'm Sigourney.
It's absolutely shocking. Later that night, me, Lauren, and Jonah Hill found ourselves waiting for an elevator to go back to our rooms. Because Vegas is a horrible clusterfuck at all times, it was taking forever for an elevator to come. So we were psyched when the doors finally opened. But there was a giant security guard standing there blocking the entrance.
Sorry, this one's private.
Then a voice came from behind the guard.
No, wait.
Eddie Griffin popped out. He eyed us.
Ashley, let them in. I want to ride with them.
I'll take this moment to say there is very little rhyme or reason to which celebrities have security and which ones don't. I've seen some of the biggest stars navigate the world relatively easily with nobody helping or protecting them. I've also seen untalented comedians who nobody really gives a flying fuck about have huge security details, but I won't name names. Back to Eddie Griffin and his huge security detail. They allowed us entrance to his elevator, and we hit the button.
I'm glad I saw you guys. I saw your movie. The high school movie.
Jonah said, Cool, that's awesome.
Yeah, I've been trying to make a movie for a while now, but nobody will make it. But they made yours. And you know why?
No, why?
Because I'm black and you're Jewish, motherfuckers.
We all kind of awkwardly laughed, thinking, praying, that this was some sort of terrible joke. You know, the kind Eddie Griffin is famous for. His guards laughed too. Oh, yeah? What do you mean by that?
I mean, you Jewish motherfuckers run Hollywood, and you only make movies with other Jewish motherfuckers.
Oh, I remember thinking, this isn't a joke. This dude is just going on a wild anti-Semitic tirade to meet Jonah and Lauren while we're trapped in a very long elevator ride with him. His security stopped laughing. Jonah said, sorry, I guess, trying to make a joke. Shockingly, Eddie was not as in tune with comedy as one might expect from a performer of his caliber, so he didn't get that Jonah was trying to let him off the hook and move on.
Don't be sorry. Tell your Jews to let other people make some movies.
Bing! We hit his floor and he got off. We all tried to process how insane it was. Not just insane that he would say that to us, but insane because he's really ignoring the fact that if there's one thing that Jewish people are not above, it's making money producing things that are fronted by black people. Anyone who's ever seen a biopic of any black musician knows the character I'm talking about, and he's usually very appropriately played by my dear friend David Krumholtz. Anti-Semitic incidents were few and far between for a while after that, but that all changed when I joined Twitter. I was constantly getting attacked by these stupid white supremacist assholes, which is annoying. But what really pissed me off is that a lot of them were verified by Twitter. I realized that Jack Dorsey, the co-founder and CEO of Twitter, followed me. So I started DMing him to express my unhappiness that his platform was verifying accounts that spread Nazi propaganda. I pointed out that sites like Gab and countless other assholes were using their verified status on Twitter to blatantly promote white supremacy and also intimidate and threaten people who disagreed with them. They were doxing enemies and spreading ideas that manifested actual violence. Over DM, Jack just kept saying, We plan on reworking this. He didn't seem that concerned or bothered. And as far as I could discern, he didn't seem like he gave a fuck. And then I tweeted that feeling. Tweet. I've been DMing with Jack about his bizarre need to verify white supremacists on his platform for the last 8 months or so, and after all the exchanges, I've reached a conclusion. The dude simply does not seem to give a fuck. July 3rd, 2018. Jack wasn't thrilled with me, although the white supremacy itself didn't seem to bug him, and he reached out to get on the phone. I could only assume he hoped I would feel better about the situation after our talk. I felt catastrophically worse. I asked him to explain how the verification process works. He said that it basically started as something he would give to his friends, a token he'd hand out to the cool kids. And by cool, I mean people who are friends with Jack Dorsey. The next evolution of verification on Twitter came after a natural disaster in an attempt to prevent the flow of false information and fraudulent charities. He actually did something good. Some government bodies started to be verified as well. Then, through a series of events that Jack himself can't explain with any certainty, verification is where it is, a place that makes no fucking sense. One would probably assume that verification is just a way of making sure you are who you say you are. But one would be wrong, because Twitter has de-verified some people not for being exposed as imposters, but because their tweets have been deemed unsavory. So it's not really a verification, it's an endorsement. Also, you might be very logically thinking, what's the big deal about being verified? It's just a blue check, which is what I thought before I found out that being verified does prioritize and push your tweets across the platform. If you're verified, Twitter will amplify your message. I tried desperately to understand Jack's take on the situation. I started with the elephant in the room. Me, trying to sound smart. You're aware that almost weekly, the president is in blatant violation of your terms of service with regard to abusive behavior, threats, and harassment, and that kind of tells everyone that you don't care about your own terms of service. It seems like you're choosing what to enforce and not to enforce, and right now, you're not enforcing very much regarding white supremacy.
Yeah, I really hear that. We have to rework the verification process from the ground up.
When do you plan on doing that?
We don't know right now. First and foremost, I think our communication is failing us.
I kind of think what you're communicating is failing you.
Well, first and foremost, we're dedicated to promoting healthy conversation.
Huh? What?
Healthy conversation, a healthy dialogue. Conversation.
How do you promote healthy conversation?
We're working on that.
Okay, well, in the meantime, do you plan on de-verifying some white supremacists just so their message isn't amplified? I'd imagine it's easy to monitor their tweets to see if they're abusive or harmful.
We don't have the resources to do this.
Huh?
We really just don't have the resources to do that at this time.
Me? Trying not to condescend to a guy who created a billion-dollar company? Well, I run a small company, and even I know that I don't have enough employees to make sure my highly profitable platform is operating in a way that won't get people murdered and Nazis won't come into power is not a great excuse. I mean, how about you hire more people, like a no-Nazis group?
We're looking into that.
I mean, this isn't some nebulous abstract problem. Honestly, in less time than it's taking for you to talk to me, you could just ban or at least de-verify like 15 dangerous white supremacist accounts. That could save people's lives. I'll tell you who they are right now while we're on the phone.
But remember, Seth.
I awaited his amazing founder wisdom.
Twitter is merely a mirror of society.
This drove me nuts. Like Twitter is some beautiful child that Jack had birthed into the world, squozen from his loins, an autonomous creature whose will is to be respected and revered wherever it should take us. You might want to think that, but like any creation, Twitter is an expression and representation of its creator. There's a reason that people don't hate Instagram. I've met the guy who created it. He's lovely. So, Twitter is a mirror of you. When people are saying Twitter is a cesspool, that's you. The call ended badly. About a month later, I noticed yet another barrage of anti-Semitic tweets from some verified accounts. Ron Paul tweeted a violently anti-Semitic cartoon, and a verified user named Roosh was spreading the idea that all mass shootings were perpetrated by Jews. Another user was offering to pay the legal fees of anyone who assaulted me, which I can only assume he got from Trump, who said the same shit about people who assaulted his protesters. Jack got back to me and said he'd look into it. For some crazy reason, I actually believed him. A few weeks later, in October 2018, I found myself living in downtown Pittsburgh. I just moved there for a few months to film an American Pickle. I woke up one Saturday morning and checked my phone, learning about the Tree of Life terrorist attack minutes after it started, about 3 miles from where I was sitting. It would go on to be the worst act of anti-Jewish violence in the history of the United States of America. I felt sick to my stomach. I spent the day walking around the city. Everywhere I went, I saw the same shocked look on people's faces. People were asking, how could this happen? And unfortunately, the answer is obvious. First, it's real easy to get your hands on a high-powered assault rifle in America. Combine that with a president who destigmatized outward hatred and social media platforms that allow people to stoke flames of hatred to the point of combustion. Because of Twitter, the shooter didn't see himself as a villain. He saw himself as a hero. This guy thought Jews were facilitating the entrance of terrorists into the country, an idea that's perpetuated by countless verified Twitter accounts, right-wing news outlets, and GOP politicians. And without Jack doing anything to stop the spread of these lies, all he was telling people was that they were not lies. If they were, he wouldn't be endorsing and amplifying them, right? Wouldn't he take the verification away from the people who spread the lies if they were in fact lies? No action, no infraction. It all must be true. One of the first times the militant anti-Semitic right wing started to target me online was after I told off Ben Carson for saying that Jews could have protected themselves better during the Holocaust if they'd had easier access to guns. A crazy idea that not only blames Jews for being victims, but uses the deaths of the Holocaust to bolster America's ridiculous gun laws. These victim-blaming talking points were being repeated just hours after the shooting, not only by the media, but by the president himself. The idea that it's up to the threatened classes to protect themselves from bigots rather than up to the bigots not to spread hatred and act on their terrible instincts is as stupid as, well, Trump. Everyone knows people hate Jews. Lock the doors next time. So comforting. Jack's too-little-too-late approach to monitoring his own website really kicked into high gear around the 2020 presidential election. After losing the election, Trump did something nobody except those with eyes and a brain saw coming. He refused to admit he lost, and the spineless fuckheads in the GOP decided to support this lie, even though they knew it was complete bullshit. Lucky for them, their supporters don't care about reality, so it was ultimately an easy lie to sell. In the days following the election, Jack took action that he probably thought was super helpful. Every time Trump tweeted a lie about election fraud, he put a little notice under the tweet saying that some news sources disputed the information in the tweet. Keep in mind, at the same time, verified news sites like One America News Network and Newsmax were also supporting Trump's Twitter lies, effectively negating whatever these little notices were supposed to be doing in the first place. Twitter allowed Trump and other verified feeds to spread the lie that the election was stolen until there was a violent and deadly insurrection on January 6th, 2021, the day the Electoral College votes were being officially counted. After that, I guess Jack scrounged up some more resources because he finally banned Trump from Twitter, and the following week, misinformation about the election dropped 75%. As of the writing of this, One America News Network, Newsmax, and dozens of other politicians and journalists are still verified by Twitter despite pushing the dangerous lie that there was mass voter fraud in the 2020 election and that Trump actually won, even though there's absolutely no evidence to support this. Gab, the white supremacist social media site, is still verified and having its message amplified by Twitter. Roosh, the verified user I pointed out to Jack years ago, is still verified, and as of this writing, Twitter is amplifying his messages that the Jews committed the Tree of Life shooting themselves to curry political favor. Acts of anti-Semitism went up 57% in 2019. You can follow me on Twitter, at Seth Rogen. Xenu. I get as awkward and uncomfortable around famous people as any person who is not famous. If anything, I might get more awkward because I'm a huge movie fan. I love them so much I dedicated my entire life to them, so I get starstruck. What being famous affords you is a high level of access. And not only are you meeting these famous people, which, again, is strange in the first place, but you're meeting them in incredibly odd situations. I've been in a ton of elevators with famous people, which, as I've illustrated, can be terrible. You generally acknowledge that you are indeed both famous people, and some level of conversation is expected. I felt so bad for Bono the time he desperately tried to converse with me in a long freight elevator ride at 30 Rock. The most awkward elevator ride I ever went on was at the Oscars. I was about to present an award and found myself in an elevator with Heath Ledger's parents about 30 seconds after they had just accepted his posthumous Oscar for The Dark Knight. I stared at them silently and awkwardly as they stood there holding the statue. I felt like I had to say something, and to this day, I regret my choice. Congratulations! But short interactions are manageable. It's the long exposure that becomes tricky. Trying to relate to megastars for substantial amounts of time is grueling, if not impossible. And never was that more clear than the time we were beckoned to Tom Cruise's house. It was 2006, and we were in the middle of filming the movie Knocked Up, and Tom Cruise was in the middle of having what seemed like a manic episode in the most public way imaginable. He was dating Katie Holmes, leaping off furniture at the mere thought of his feelings for her. They had just had a baby, Suri, but no image of the child had been published, leading to genuine speculation as to whether or not she even existed. The fact that the thought, hey, I wonder if he is just pretending to have a baby, was even on the table speaks to how strangely the public viewed him at that time. And in the midst of all of that, Judd comes up to me on set one day.
Tom Cruise wants to meet us.
What? Why?
He's thinking of doing a comedy and he wants to brainstorm.
And we want to take this meeting?
Of course. We're going as soon as we wrap filming for the day.
When we finished shooting, I drove across town toward Tom's house, which was right above Sunset Boulevard. I was nervous for a lot of reasons. I wasn't sure we should be meeting with him at all. He seemed to be in a strange place, and the idea of becoming the outlet for a manic movie star's desire to publicly restore his image was a service I wanted to reserve for myself. I also just generally didn't like meeting really famous people because it gave me anxiety, and I almost always felt worse after I met them. I was running late, and I had to pee very, very badly. As I drove up Sunset, I couldn't find anywhere to go, and I started to get worried that the first words I'd speak to Tom Cruise would be, "I'm about to pee in my pants. Can I please use your restroom?" I pulled up to the gate and hit the buzzer. "I'm here to see Tom." The gate slowly opened. I was actually going to pee in my pants, which would be the worst impression one could make. I started to snake up his long wooded driveway when I noticed a Snapple bottle on the floor of my car. I had no choice. I stopped halfway up the driveway and peed into the Snapple bottle. It came dangerously close to overflowing. I sealed the lid, put the bottle in my back seat, and continued up the driveway. After a turn around the bend, I arrived at a huge house with Tom Cruise, Katie Holmes, and little baby Suri waiting to greet me. I gave him a hearty handshake, which I still feel guilty about given the circumstances. I had actually met Katie before because I was in an episode of Dawson's Creek a few years earlier. She had a vague, please rescue me from this place look on her face. The baby was adorable and real. Judd arrived a couple minutes later and we went to Tom's screening room to sit down and chat. We talked for about 5 hours, and it was a ride. We talked about movies he loved, what we were making, things like that. He told some stories about Stanley Kubrick, which were great to hear, and he talked about this new director, J.J. Abrams, whom he was working with on the new Mission Impossible movie. It was all totally normal. Until it wasn't. For those of you who don't know, Scientology is a religion slash cult slash pyramid scheme invented by coke-addled moron slash science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard. Basically, Scientologists believe that 75 million years ago, there was a galactic confederacy that was ruled by an evil alien named Xenu. Xenu brought billions of his alien friends to Earth, put them in a volcano, and exploded them with a hydrogen bomb. The spirits of the aliens, known as Thetans, adhered to the spirits of humans on Earth, and the journey of becoming a high-ranking Scientologist is one of shedding your Thetans and becoming clear of them. Then you get superpowers and shit. Overall, it's not much crazier than any other religion, but the fact that it was literally made by a guy who wrote terrible science fiction books that essentially have the same plot probably docks it a few points. Also, they don't believe in treating mental illness or depression with drugs. About 4 hours into the meeting, it finally came up. The conversation slowly veered into how the public thought he was losing his mind.
Well, yeah, they're making it seem like I'm losing my mind.
Making it seem like it?
Yeah. There's a coordinated effort to make it appear that way.
Who would do that?
The pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And why would they do that?
Because my exposure of their fraud has cost them so much money that they're desperate. They're scrambling, and they're doing everything they can to discredit me so I won't hurt sales anymore.
Big Pharma made you jump on Oprah's couch?
They edited it to make it look so much worse than it was. They do that all the time. You should see what they do to my friend, Louis Farrakhan.
Of all the strange sentences I've heard in my life, this one coming out of Tom Cruise's mouth is in the top.